as a small business owner, not to say you don't have to be worried about what's going on in Washington, but in terms of your like return on your time and effort, you're going to get so much more by becoming active and getting other people in your community to make those phone calls or to stop by and to see those representatives or to use the courts or whatever it is that you need to do. But a lot of that is done and change can really be affected on a local level with a lot fewer people making bigger waves. But we also forget about doing what we need to do in our own backyards.
Is there a war on small business? According to an online review of her book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America, entrepreneur Carol Roth unveils the many abuses of power inflicted on small businesses during the COVID-19 pandemic. Small business owners were thrown in jail for trying to make a living. Individual rights were discarded. Big government did what it does best, intentionally protect the rich and powerful. Today's guest has extensive experience working with businesses of all sizes. Carol Roth was named a top 100 small business influencer, written hundreds of articles for a variety of outlets, is a sought-after MC, speaker, and event moderator, and describes herself as a recovering investment banker, having completed initiatives for companies worth more than $2 billion. I'm Tony Melandra, NFIB California Senior Media Manager. We're proud to have this podcast supported in part by Five Star Bank, serving customers through specialized banking solutions for entrepreneurs, business owners, and community leaders in Northern California. Here to talk with Carol Roth is NFIB California's Chief Legislative Advocate, Tim Taylor, who, in addition to representing clients in his own firm since 2009, brings longtime state government and state legislative experience to the job. Take it away, Tim.
Thank you, Tony, for that introduction, and welcome, Carol Roth. Very pleased to have you. I've been a fan of yours for a while. I read The War on Small Business, and I found it to be revelatory. It's about what the name of the title implies, but in a sense, it's also an ode to small businesses. Can you kind of tell me about the role of small businesses in creating the most prosperous country in the history of the world?
Yeah, no, first of all, thanks for having me. And obviously, I've been a longtime fan, advocate, supporter, friend of NFIB. So it's wonderful to have this conversation. And I've also been a long-term advocate of small business because, you know, as they say, small business is the backbone of America. And it's not said that, you know, for no reason. Prior to the pandemic, about half the jobs and about half the GDP was controlled in 30 some odd million small businesses' hands, very decentralized, and really is emblematic of the American dream. You know, whether you are from this country or coming here with a dream, a vision from any part of the globe, that is a big piece of it, the opportunity to create your own path. And it has been a huge part of, you know, not only increasing the GDP and the overall scope of prosperity in America, but letting that be very horizontal, letting lots of people participate in that, you know, versus the other half of the GDP and jobs, which are highly concentrated in about 20 some odd thousand big businesses. So when you think about the role of, you know, having this disparate group of people who have the opportunity to pursue individual wealth creation opportunities on their own terms, it's very exciting. But at the same time, they have created jobs, they have created needed products and services, they have allowed for choice, they have been competition and pushback against centralization in this country. So it's really fundamental to who not only America is, but in many cases, how businesses are created around the world.
Very good. Thank you. I agree with that 100%. You know, you write an entire chapter in the book on AB5. I think a lot of people around the country don't really know any bill by number per se, but they know AB5, at least a lot of them do. This was a very pernicious bill. It has a long history. Your synopsis of it, I thought, was particularly insightful. Can you talk about gig workers, freelancers, and how meaningful they are to an economy?
Yes. When you talk about the concept of choice, and people talk about this in all different kinds of realms, healthcare choice and other kinds of choices, for some reason, work choice never seems to come into that discussion. And I think it's a really critical part of freedom. The advent of, you know, the kind of the new wave of digital technology has really enabled people to work flexibly in the way that they want to work. And that's exciting for people. And the gig economy lets people say, I have free time, or perhaps I'm, you know, kind of like me who likes to do a million different things over the course of any given week. And so I want to be able to fill that time in the way that I want. And instead of having an employer or maybe even putting out capital to start sort of a traditional small business, I'm going to be my own boss in a different way via the gig economy. And obviously there are millions and millions of different examples, and it has become a really substantial part of the economy. So the idea that people have free choice about the way that they want to go to work, I think is something that everybody should accept. But unfortunately, coming out of California, which you and I know all too well, lots of, you know, nuttier than a jar of peanut butter ideas, but also, you know, very highly destructive ideas, is, you know, saying, no, I'm sorry, you know, even though you and your company that you want to do this arrangement with have come to a term, we're going to get in the middle of that contract. We're going to say, nope. We don't like the way that you guys have decided to work, and we are going to force you into a relationship that you two have not agreed upon. And I think just, you know, from a macro standpoint, you could say, well, that seems really silly. And it doesn't matter if you're wrapping it under the idea of, oh, well, this is for your protection. As we know, for your protection, you know, sort of weasel words. We want to be able to have the freedom to pursue it our own way. And when the polling has been done of people in the gig economy saying, do you want to be a gig worker or do you want to be an employee? The majority of people say, I want to be a gig worker. If I wanted to be an employee, I would have gone that route, but I want to have that flexibility. And they say, oh, well, what about health insurance? Okay, well, a lot of people have health insurance through some of their other jobs, or perhaps through the open markets that, you know, have now been created, you know, or through a spouse or a partner. So just because there are these other issues that may be out there, it doesn't mean that somebody should be able to get in the middle of the contract. And so, you know, not only is this something that's reared its head in California, but they're trying to make it a thing nationally via the PRO Act and, you know, other potential legislation as well. And it's so fundamentally un-American and such a huge infringement on freedom and choice to get in this middle of this agreement and say, I'm sorry, we are going to take away from you the freedom to work the way that you want.
Always under the guise of, we're doing this for you. We're doing this for your benefit.
For the children, yes.
I mean, I'm not generally opposed on a basic level to unions, but when somebody who is now the California Labor Federation president says, we're really doing this for you, it should make people a little bit suspicious.
Yeah, no, it's obviously a lot of these things happen under the guise of it's for you, but usually, you know, human nature kicks in and it ends up enriching the people at the top. And so, you know, I have no problem with people coming up with their own options and saying, I don't want to do this voluntarily and saying, this isn't for me. But if somebody says voluntarily, this is the way that I choose to live my life, my labor, my choice should be what follows.
Yeah, my work, my choice. We usually supplant that first word with something other than work. And it should be my work, my choice, 100%. It's a great kind of tagline, I think. Have you been following at all the unemployment insurance debacle in California at all?
I mean, just from a very macro level, whether it's unemployment insurance or, you know, what was done in COVID and structuring some of those programs or, you know, so on and so forth. There are so many debacles, it's kind of hard to keep each one of them separate. But feel free to get granular on what specific thing you wanted
to go
into.
Well, specifically, it was the fraudulent claims that were paid out by the EDD in California. And there's probably always going to be some level of fraud in those kinds of programs, like there are in welfare and other sorts of programs where the state is giving individuals money. But in this case, after small businesses were shut down, some of them forcibly and deemed to be non-essential, a lot of people were out of work and applying for uninsurance benefits. The state paid out $30 billion plus in fraudulent claims. $30 billion. That is larger than like 20 states' budgets. That is a massive number. And what's transpired since then is they need to recover. So there's sort of an escrow account that's done at the federal level that you pay the claims out of. So we were obviously, you know, we had some amount of money, $10 billion or something like that in the fund prior to COVID. Now we're down $22.2 billion or something to that. We actually don't know the true nature of the fraud because it started out as $10 billion, then it was $20 billion, $30 billion. I've even heard now upwards of $40 billion. But the real niggling point of why I bring this up isn't just government incompetence. It's because they're now saying that 70% of that, potentially 70%, went to criminal organizations. So if you're paying, let's say, billion, I wish it were million, to criminal organizations who want to hurt the country, and I think of fentanyl coming across the border, all sorts of issues like this, this is devastating. This should be something that I believe really should be investigated thoroughly.
Yeah, and the challenge is that there is no accountability. So, you know, this is one of just many ways that the ball has been dropped with all these funds, lots of fraud, the PPP program, the way that it was structured, not only sent money to big companies, but just to straight up fraudulent enterprises. And people use that money to buy Lamborghinis and exotic trips and things like that. And it's very frustrating because what happened with small businesses being mandated, as you said, that the most horrible word I've ever heard is non-essential. They were deemed non-essential by various states and localities and then forced to shut down. In my mind, you know, that falls under eminent domain in terms of the Constitution. We are taking your business for the public good, saying you can't use it, and you're entitled to due compensation. And whether it's the program that you're referencing, PPP or some of the ones that come after, that didn't nearly come to, you know, a dollar amount that made sense in terms of taking people's businesses for the public good. So you already had this huge affront to small businesses. And certainly we know how Wall Street was bailed out and the big businesses were bailed out and the small businesses had to jump through the hoop. But now seeing there's this all of this money that went, you know, to fraudulent organizations, to criminal organizations that could have helped real small businesses survive and thrive, and then is now going to do evil. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just kind of like just getting pummeled, you know, one right. fist after another. You know, you get the jab and then you get the hook and then you get the uppercut and you just cannot give up. And there's no accountability. And I think that's the issue here is that we can scream about it. We can look into it. They can try and recover some of it. But until people are held accountable for making these kinds of mistakes, nothing is going to shift. There is just moral hazard throughout the entire system because of that lack of accountability. And I just don't see a shift until that happens.
And Julie Sue was the one in charge during that time, and she's being rewarded right now in confirmation hearings as the labor secretary potentially, right? So there's zero accountability there. I would also say that final left Tyson hook to the jaw to employers was that they were deemed to be non-essential, but now that we're having to pay back some of that, they have been deemed to be essential once again. And they are the ones on the hook. There is a $434 payroll tax per employee assessed against small businesses to pay for that when, in fact, they were shut down initially. I think it's a travesty, actually.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely despicable. And if you think about in various locales, like you said, that it's not like you didn't have to pay your property taxes. It's not like your rent was abated. It's not like you got any of these other special perks. You had to, if you had lived in a state where you have to pay for filings, many of those people had to pay for all of those things to maintain their business, at the same time saying, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to actually produce any revenue, or the way that you do it has to be limited based on these ridiculous things that, by the way, had absolutely nothing to do with data and science and completely had to do with cloud connections. Because while you couldn't get your nails or hair done at a small business, down the street at a big box store, your dog could get their nails and their fur done at that big box store. So this was completely non-science based and was targeted at the backbone of America, because those companies and their owners don't have the clout and connections and the ability to lobby and the ability to support the campaigns. And frankly, they stand in the way of centralization. So whether you think that it's, you know, oh, we just don't care about you because you don't do enough for us, or intentional because that business then goes over to the big companies, either way, it's just a really, really bad outcome for America.
And I really like, and you kind of touched upon it there, your concept of the Black Swan event that you write about in your book. And it's really interesting. When I was first reading that and you said the pandemic was not a black swan, I thought, yeah, actually, wasn't it a black swan? Seems like a black swan to me. But then when you sort of unfurled the theory, it really made a lot of sense. It wasn't just the pandemic, or it wasn't the pandemic solely. It was the government response to the pandemic that was the true black swan. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so a black swan is phrased by Mr. Taleb, that, you know, in the book of the same name, that basically it is an event, usually an economic event, that no one can predict, and it just kind of comes out of nowhere. And everyone said this pandemic was a black swan, and it 100% was not a black swan, because several months before, in 2019, several states and the government and various entities held a series of exercises called Crimson Contagion, where they ran this exact scenario. Oh, something escapes from a lab in China. What are we going to do? I mean, it's like they actually wrote the playbook. I'm not going to have any conspiracy around that, but they had a scenario that was really, really close to what happened. So that was something that was expected. People had talked about pandemics pretty widely before. And so, you know, that was not what was unexpected and came out of nowhere. What came out of nowhere and what no one expected, and this was sort of the only thing that I have gotten wrong, I think, in this entire trajectory, was that the government said, we are going to shut down a third of the economy. And on top of that, the American people went, okay, yeah, we're going to do that. That is the Black Swan event. And that is what has created all of the issues, by the way, that we are seeing today, you know, from, you know, this crazy inflation to the disruption in the labor market. All of these long tail effects are from that black swan, because really nobody would have guessed that the United States would say, we're going to shut down small businesses, we're going to shut down a third of the economy, and we're going to let this go on and on. So that's really the unexpected piece. But I've learned my lesson from that, and it's really opened my eyes to, you know, what can unfortunately be done, and the freedoms that the government now feels entitled to be able to infringe upon, because so much of the population either, you know, kind of turned their heads, or in the case of many of them, became cheerleaders and advocates for.
Yeah, I was surprised by how docile the public turned out to be in that regard. I would not have suspected that in the United States, maybe another country, perhaps, but not in the land of freedom and entrepreneurship and people who have fought in wars to preserve those sorts of things that we take so dearly, and some of those fundamental rights that we hold so dearly in this country. I don't think that would have happened, say, 20, 30 years ago. Just because I think the mental fortitude of the country was different then. I don't think they would have stood for it.
Yeah, as I said, it was a complete surprise. I had this conversation with my husband in February 2020. I actually had OG COVID. I got it in February. At the time, they thought it was something else, but I found out afterwards from having the antibodies that that's in fact what it was, and it all kind of aligned. But we went through this exercise and we said, okay, if this comes here in the way that it's hitting Italy and China, you know, do you think people would go along with it? It was like, of course not. But what they did was very clever, right? They didn't shut down the entire economy. The Fed ran in. The very first, you know, action that was taken was to support Wall Street. If Wall Street had been in a free fall situation, if your local grocery store was closed, if Amazon couldn't deliver packages, if you couldn't get, you know, these things that you come to expect, I don't think this lasts 2 weeks. I think that, you know, these big companies, they, this is totally unacceptable. We're not doing this. And we move right to the mitigation stance that we should have had, you know, kind of been in immediately and eventually got to. But they were like, this is great. So you're going to shut down our competitors. Those dollars are going to come to us directly. And then the Fed is going to come support us in the market and put all this money in the market. And then we're going to all of a sudden hit new highs. I mean, the tech companies were hitting highs in June of 2020, you know, less than 3 months after that support was done. And, you know, transferred trillions of dollars of wealth in the process from Main Street to Wall Street. So they were like, this is great. Let's just keep this going for as long as possible. And the same thing, you know, at the state level where you had these governors that had all this power and they were power hungry. And now all of a sudden, you know, they could act out their fantasy of, you know, being king or queen of whatever. And so by dividing up the population into essential and non-essential, and small businesses are closed, but those big players aren't, it was just a very clever way for them to enact that consolidation and to get that support, which I think would have been a very different situation. And we would have entirely avoided the mess that we are in today if that had been the case.
And let's pivot to your new book. Thank you for that. That was very important.
Hi, I'm James Beckwith, President and CEO of Five Star Bank. We are excited to help bring you this series of podcasts focused on small business concerns in conjunction with the NFIB. When Five Star Bank was founded in 1999, it was business and community leaders, local entrepreneurs, who wanted to create the sort of personalized banking services they desired themselves. Services inspired by partnership and defined by shared vision and goals. A true understanding of the needs of small business owners. I know a meaningful relationship with a banker can be hard to find. At Five Star Bank, we are responsive, understand your business, and are committed to your success. We want to be a part of your growth and a valued partner supporting your vision and your dreams. You'll find direct access to a banker, complete online and mobile business banking you need to succeed. As an SBA preferred lender, let us help you with your startup business or existing business. If you're looking to make a change, please give us the opportunity to demonstrate what our personalized banking services could mean for you. I promise you individual attention from our colleagues who understand your business and are as committed to your success as you are. You can find us online at fivestarbank.com.
You also speak about the wealth transfer was not just driving consumers or customers to big box businesses, right? It was also, there was also a lending side to it. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so that's, as I talked about, you know, the Fed comes into the market and, you know, we were already on the tail end of more than a decade of easy money policy, but they had tightened just a wee bit. And they said, no, 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 we've got to save the economy, which they weren't saving the economy. This was not helping small business. They were helping Wall Street. It was not helping spenders and savers. It was helping Wall Street. So what they did is they went back to their zero interest rate policy and they decided to print trillions and trillions of dollars. And basically, if you were somebody who, you know, was retired or trying to save, you earned next to nothing on your money. But if you were a big company, all of a sudden you're able to load up on all of this debt and fortify your balance sheet and create this huge disparity at the same time that you have these small businesses like praying, jumping through hoops to, you know, maybe get a loan with their bank if they filled out everything appropriately and, oh, you know, that got, you know, completely used up quickly and then they had to go and re-engineer the program. So it was just a very different set of outcomes. And then on top of that, then they decided to do these direct stimulus payments. and keep people on the sideline, which crushed the labor force. And it really did create the situation that we're seeing today. You know, the banking crisis that we're in is because you had the Federal Reserve and the government doing all of the stimulus more than the market demanded. And so when the banks, you know, had all these companies that were flush with cash, they were saying, okay, great, we'll take this money, but we have nothing to do with it. We don't have the demand for loans. We don't have, you know, enough to do with, oh, maybe we'll offer 1% loans on mortgages to rich people, or maybe we'll stick them in treasuries for 10 years. And then, you know, again, we have the direct stimulus to individuals, which we all knew was going to cause inflation. But people are like, no, I need my $1,000 that's going to end up costing me $6,000 a year for my family now for, you know, the rest of time, because people don't have that level of financial literacy. So the issues that we're seeing today obviously created that huge amount of inflation that was completely predictable. And, you know, the Fed decided that they were going to completely change course too late and, of course, too fast. And then that put more pressure on the banks, because now they've done this kind of easy money decisions and kind of said, oh, we just thought that would continue forever. And then, you know, they're in a situation with an imbalance. And now you've got banks that are shuttering. You've got people who can't pay for their groceries or their rent because of inflation. And this was all driven by those decisions that really accelerated from those decisions made related to COVID. And so it's just, you know, one financial mess after another.
I see one challenge you must have, and that is deciding when to wrap up a book. I'm sure the publisher has something to do with that, but it just seems like it's been one thing after another. And you are coming out with a new book, You Will Own Nothing. Obviously, that's a play on the World Economic Forum's You Will Own Nothing and Be Happy, which is rather creepy, to say the least. What is that book about? I know it hasn't come out. I have pre-ordered it, by the way, so I'm really looking forward to reading it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, first of all, thank you for your support, and I'm very excited to get it to you. If you enjoyed The War on Small Business, I think you'll see a continuation of a lot of those themes. But obviously what happened during COVID, I think, opened a lot of our eyes to, as we said, things that we didn't think would happen just a few years ago that we're now open to, okay, that's not really a conspiracy, that's an actual reality or probability. And so when I first heard about the World Economic Forum and this, you know, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, I was like, okay, come on, there's no way that this is a prediction that's coming out of there. This is a group of the elite of the elite. It's connected to political leaders and the top business leaders. Like, there's no way this group is like, hey, in like 7 years, there'll be no private property. And so I went out and, you know, did some research and went, oh, they actually did say that. That's super frightening, along with a bunch of other things. And you start to look around and hear some of the other things that people are saying and saying very much aloud. Things like a new financial world order, a new world order, which again sounds highly conspiratorial, except for the fact that the president of the United States, Joe Biden, said that to the business roundtable in March of 2022 in a speech, and it's on the White House's website, and you can go to, you know, many other places to see similar leaders. And you start doing the research and you remember, well, you know, if you think about it, we're about 80 years into being the center of the global universe. And before us, it was the British. And before the British, it was the Dutch. And I'm sure at those points in times, the people in those societies felt like they were invincible and that they were only going to be the center of the world forever. And you start seeing some of the things that have happened in terms of the decisions that the Federal Reserve has made in terms of not only holding our money unstable in the U.S., but also the same on the world stage. You see some of the choices that have been made in energy and the push for part of the world to, you know, de-dollarize. You see things like big tech trying to, you know, wrench your life back to you as a service or a subscription and you not really owning anything. you see coming out of the Great Recession financial crisis and all the stimulus that we've been talking about, corporations who are now, which, you know, by the way, never were in the market for single family homes, are now competing with people to purchase a home, the American dream. You see millennials who are actually making more on an inflation adjusted basis than Gen X or boomers did at the same time, not being able to consolidate wealth or even buy homes. And you start connecting the dots and you're like, yeah, you'll own nothing. You'll own nothing. I mean, even coming out of COVID, you know, some of the decisions, some of the social credit things that happened, you know, if you wouldn't take a vaccine and you wouldn't have your vax passport, you know, they came after your social standing, which is your opportunity for wealth. They came after jobs in some cases, which is, you know, the way that you're earning to create wealth. And, you know, if you were in Canada and you were a trucker, they actually came after literal wealth. And by the way, U.S. tech companies were the ones who colluded on that. So there are all of these forces that become very clear that see this new financial world order taking shape, saying that the U.S.'s run is a little long in the tooth. You know, how do we jockey to control all the resources? And so the book really kind of explores each of those things and other topics like ESG and connects the dots. And most importantly, gives people a plan to fight back, because it's not acceptable to me. They may want you to own nothing, but I want you to own everything. And obviously, property rights is central to our individual rights and our freedom as a country. So I think it's going to be a really good roadmap to empower people to see where all of this is happening and be able to make those connections and then create that plan to fight back.
And I hope we have the will to fight back. I really do. We need to preserve the country. Do you go into in the book, I know it's not out yet, as we highlighted, MMT? Modern
I always give a nod to MMT, yeah. Modern Monetary Theory. I like to call it Magic Money Tree, because that's basically what it is. And so I do spend a little bit of time on it. You know, my analogy for Magic Money Tree is it's a sad one, but I think it's a good one, is that they say, oh, well, just because we have access, you know, to print our own money, we can never go into debt. Well, my mom many years ago had leukemia, and when she was treated by doctors, they ended up radiating her whole body and they killed the leukemia, but they also killed her. And they were celebrating, well, hey, we were able to kill the leukemia. And it's like, well, that's not the point. Look what you destroyed in the process. And that's what MMT is. And technically, I guess that is the case, you can cover any debt, but not without destroying the value of the money, which doesn't have, you know, random intrinsic value. It's a proxy for our productivity. So if you're not increasing productivity and you're increasing the money that you print, obviously that's going to end up in debasement.
Yeah.
And so I do talk about that as well as other, you know, kind of debasements throughout history. I talk, you know, a little bit about the Roman Empire and how much of that was actually the fall of that was because of the debasement of the currency. And I think it's a really good thing for people who have a hard time kind of wrapping their head around it, but understanding that, like, you know, they had a coin called the denarius that was like 95% silver. And what happened is that, you know, they held that stable for like 300 years because the emperors knew that stable money equaled a stable society. And then you get to Nero, and Nero's like, oh, I could use some of that. So he would call the coins in circulation, melt them down, and either have a smaller coin or replace them with something else and keep that extra silver for himself and to pay for the wars. And that, you know, went on and on, you know, not just during his reign, but afterwards. And that denarius ended up going from 95% silver to 0.5% silver. And so I think that's like a really good for people who don't quite understand all the details. You can just kind of see, oh, we've shrunk this down so much, there's only this much silver left. That's what's basically happening with your dollar. So, you know,
and it was supposed to have had the same value. So essentially they were on the silver standard and went off the silver standard. And that, wow. I look forward to reading that. That's fascinating. No,
it's basically taking something that sounds super conspiratorial and putting a lot of common sense research behind it. It's very hard to say a new world order is a conspiracy theory when you can point to Joe Biden saying it in front of the business roundtable and having it on the White House.
I think very little sounds conspiratorial these days.
Unfortunately, I think that you're right about that.
Yeah. So as dire as all of this sounds, there's got to be a silver lining. We're all fighting. We're in the trenches here at NFIB in California, in the legislature and other places around the country. What can we do to improve the direction in which we're headed, turn the ship, survive, and then thrive once again?
So I think that there are things that you can do sort of at the personal and the business level, and then certainly at the community and broader level. But one of the great things about business ownership is it's very aligned with the you will own everything phenomenon. I mean, the way that people create wealth is through ownership of assets that increase in value. So having people invested in businesses and hopefully sharing that. I mean, to the extent that you can get your employees, you know, some stock options and have them participate in the growth of the business, even if it's a small business, gives more people that opportunity to be invested in growth and the opportunity to create wealth. So I do think that this is, you know, remains an important thing. And certainly we all have to be aware of the issues and the entities that are coming, you know, in trying to make that harder and building barriers. But it's still very important. And I would say also that just making individual choices about, you know, if you spend your dollars, think about spending them, you know, with small businesses and creating alliances and supporting each other and reaching out to your customers and reminding them how important it is. Because I think at a fundamental level, people do want to support entrepreneurs and small businesses. They're just lazy and they forget. And we can't just have like one small business Saturday and, you know, a couple days during National Small Business, we can go, oh, yay, small business. And then like forget about them for like the other 360 days of the year. It's important that people understand that this is relevant to their community and to freedom and to wealth creation. And I think people want to buy into that. So, you know, if you're going to buy You Will Own Nothing, you certainly can buy it through Amazon. I'm happy. But, you know, maybe you buy it at your local small business bookseller. Maybe you buy it through bookshop.org that fulfills from a small business bookseller. You have these choices to make pretty much everything that you do. Some things are going to make sense and some things aren't. But try to be more intentional and try to align with small businesses and be advocates and allies for each other. Because I think that's the challenge with being individualist, right, and free-spirited, is that we're all kind of standing as these islands alone, but there are so many of us, and we can and have that individual perspective, but also align with like-minded people. And so I think that that's, you know, really important.
Yeah, how you spend your dollars. Those consumer choices are so important. I agree with that. I would also say, being in the government relations sort of business, that, you know, talk to your mayors, your city councilmen, your board of supervisors, assembly members, state senators, all the way up the food chain, who really make your voices heard to protect small businesses, because they do listen. They have to, you know, they're elected officials. And while sometimes they're on the other side of the fence, you'd be surprised at how often they really do listen, unless something is really driven from the top down, from leadership down. They like to hear from people.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, small business is one of those issues that actually is much more of a local community and state issue than it is a national issue. And so you, as a small business owner, not to say you don't have to be worried about what's going on in Washington, but in terms of your like return on your time and effort, you're going to get so much more by becoming active and getting other people in your community to make those phone calls or to stop by and to see those representatives or to use the courts or whatever it is that you need to do. But a lot of that is done, and change can really be affected on a local level with a lot fewer people making bigger waves, so to speak, because it is that smaller pond. And so I think we sometimes lose perspective and want to go, oh, I can't believe that they're talking about this in D.C., but we also forget about, you know, doing what we need to do in our own backyard. So I think your thoughts on that, and I think that all makes a lot of sense.
And patronize small businesses, because they are hardworking, they are family run, local, and we need them to survive, I think, for our country to survive.
So survive and to thrive. You know, we can't just have them hanging on by a thread and feeling like they're under fire at all time. We want small businesses in this country to thrive, and we want to attract more entrepreneurs to come in and be able to provide those needed goods and services that add value to the economy and to the fabric of the country. So amen to that. And I will keep doing what I can to spread the message and to be a resource.
Carol, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. As I said in the outset, I'm a big fan of yours. I look forward to reading your next book. And I encourage everybody to read your books, because it seems like it's theoretical, but it's not. It's really stuff that has practical application, and it explains what's going on in the world. You don't have to be an economist to read these. You just have to be a citizen who spends money or who has a small business, and they're of incredible value.
Well, I appreciate it. Empower yourself and take action. And thank you and the rest of NFIB for doing what you do and for being such great advocates. And thanks again for the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol Roth and Tim Taylor, for your insights for this podcast. Again, we'd like to thank Five Star Bank for its generous support of this and future podcasts. You can learn more about Five Star at fivestarbank.com. You can find all NFIB California podcasts at nfib.com/ca/podcasts. That's nfib.com/ca/podcasts. You can also find our podcasts on your favorite podcast app by searching NFIB California. I would also like to thank MultiPoint Content Strategies for its production of this podcast. You can learn more about them at multipointstrategies.com. Why podcasts for small business? It has been NFIB's educational mission for 80 years to remind policymakers that small businesses are not smaller versions of big businesses, and that a one-size-fits-all rule, regulation, or tax can do Main Street enterprises more harm than good. We hope these podcasts aid in better understanding. Finally, thank you to our listeners. If you like what you heard, please share this episode, subscribe, and give us a positive rating. We would appreciate it.